Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Today, we are airing highlights from our March Get Lit with All of It book club event. Our guest of honor was writer Patricia Lockwood, a celebrated poet and memoirist. You may know her from her 2017 memoir, Priest Daddy. We spent all month reading her debut novel, No One Is Talking About This. Now, Patricia and the protagonist of her novel have a few things in common. Both of these women saw their careers take off when something they posted went viral. In the case of Patricia, it was a heartbreaking poem. In the case of our protagonist, it was a post that said, "Can a dog be twins?" Patricia and our protagonist also share the same tragedy, losing a niece before her first birthday due to complications of Proteus syndrome. These two experiences form the backbone of No One Is Talking About This, which is written in kind of a fragmentary style that mimics scrolling through your Twitter feed. In the novel, our protagonist, who remains unnamed, spends all of her time on a social media platform which is called The Portal, which is basically Twitter. Going viral has given her a career and some fame, which allows her to travel around the world talking to fans and sitting on panels. But for all that The Portal has given to her, our protagonist starts to get the sense that social media is beginning to shape the way she writes, her patterns of speech, even the way she thinks. And those changes aren't necessarily for the better. It's only when family tragedy strikes that our protagonist is able to take a step back and reevaluate her relationship with the internet and with the loved ones around her. I began my conversation by asking Patricia, who also goes by Trisha, why she decided to title the novel No One Is Talking About This.
Yes. So this is sort of, it was kind of a little bit of a meme. It's something that people say a lot on Twitter, or as I call it in the book, The Portal. There is a lot of times a tweet where someone is trying to point our attention to something that in fact everyone is talking about. Everybody knows what it is and has been mm-hmm. saying a lot about it actually. And they'll end the tweet with like, "No one is talking about this!" exclamation point. And it's just kind of like a way to point to the importance of what you're talking about. It's in the same vein as things like thread, that sort of thing, that kind of convention that we've always seen. But it felt sometimes these conventions or even these memes do have this broader meaning, this sort of profundity, I think. And I felt that in this title. I called it that for a while, and then I tried to change it to People on the Sun, and we decided that we couldn't do that. It was just too, I think they really wanted me to go with something that the headline could be "Everyone is talking about this." So it was absolutely not an option that we would change it. Marketing was like, "There's no way we're keeping No One Is Talking About This."
Our narrator, she's always the narrator.
Yes.
Did she ever have a name?
She did, actually. And she had a really very specific name. It was Rachel. Because when I conceptualized the book, very specifically, we were moving apartments and I was hiding from my husband and making him do all the work. I was reading a book called Mrs. Caliban by Rachel Ingalls. And I sort of just saw the book, the beginning of it, at least at that time. And because I'm not very imaginative, I thought, well, I'm just going to call this lady Rachel for now. And I remember actually when I read a long section of it at the British Museum, which is something that also happens in the book at the very end, when I sent the London Review of Books the script, they were like, "Who's this woman Rachel? You left a couple instances of this lady's name Rachel in here." And I was like, no, take that out. We're not calling her that anymore.
Did the other characters have names as well?
No, they never did, which I think spoke a little bit to kind of a self-centered quality to it. You know, when you go into the portal, you do just become like a pure eye, really, or pure experience, I think, of your own narrative. And you're just flowing down this space. You don't necessarily think about what things or people are called. I did have people say, they were like, "The husband doesn't have a name. Someone walks into the room. Mm-hmm. That person doesn't have a name." And it's like, yeah, you're just in the portal. That's what you're doing. It's like little ghosts coming in and out of the room when you're doing that thing.
Our narrator. How much can we trust our narrator? in this book?
I think we can trust her quite a bit, actually. I think that she's probably unable to lie, maybe in the way that I am unable to lie. So there are things in the book that are fictional, but I, as a person, and I envision this for my narrator as well, like if you ask me a direct question, I will tell you the absolute truth, Catholic hand to God. And I'll even give you a little extra information that probably you didn't even ask for. Like it's a really, really bad trait to have. I went into a bar one time with a friend and we had forgotten our IDs and we sat down at the bar and he asked us what we wanted. And I looked at him and I was like, neither of us have our IDs. You cannot serve us. And my friend was like, what? Come on. Like, you have no chill. What is wrong with you? What is your problem?
So you that's just offered
what
I'm
it like. Up. I just offered it up. I was like, I do not have my ID and neither does she. Like, neither of us can have a drink. So that's kind of the person we're talking about here.
So there's the book, you know, it's interesting. A friend of mine, I said, you have to read this book. It's really great. And they were reading the first half and they're like, I really love this book. This is great. And then he said to me, the second half. I just got a tweet, a text that said, the second half. When you were writing the book, how did you think about putting these two parts, these two very different parts? They're very different, but they feel right together. I guess yeah. I'm asking, how did you do that?
No, it's a good question. And I think it's because the second half is largely autobiographical, much more so than the first half. You know, there are definitely things with dildos in the first half that aren't true, Mom, if you're watching. But the second half, that break, I experienced it as a rupture in time, really. But there was sort of something I had tuned myself to do when I was writing about the portal, which is that I was observing everything, like the little downy hairs, you know, on like the forehead of the internet, really. And I was still doing that, but it was turned to a real life situation. And then it was actually turned to a person who needed my attention and who needed my care, who needed my eye. And I felt like it's maybe what I had been developing that eye for. So I just really began to compulsively write about my niece when she was born. And before that, when my sister was pregnant, and I told my sister that I was writing about her. And I said, I can't stop. I feel it as a physical response, something I ought to be doing so that I don't lose any of it. And maybe that's the thing that was animating the first half of the book too, the desire to not lose any of it. Where does it go if we don't write it down?
Why does your protagonist spend so much time in the portal? Aside from the fame, what does she get out of it?
This is a good question too. And I think for me and some other people who use the portal in this way, I think we get stuck in it. I'm a person who for long periods will experience hyperfocus. I stim a lot. I'll read for periods of 10, 11 hours. There's something that neurodivergent people actually experience, some of them called inertia, which is not just always the inability to start something, but the inability to stop something. So if I'm doing something, a lot of times I cannot stop doing it, if that makes any sense. And so I think some people with ADD, you know, people who are on the spectrum, people who have sort of different like cognitive setups, I think sometimes just find themselves in this place and not really leaving it. But that being said, I think it's also set up to sort of exact this from people who don't have those issues too. So it is being set up to turn us into little rats who are going for the dopamine pellet. All of these apps are pretty much designed in this way. So even if you're not a person like me who, you know, can read a book for 10 hours and then can read the internet for 10 hours, I think that you can end up doing that stuff too, because it's been designed that way.
Early on in the book, the narrator, she even questions why she spends so much time in the portal. And she says it had something to do, she knew, with child chained up in the yard. Her great-grandmother, an imaginary invalid, had kept her firstborn son chained up to a stake in the front yard so she could always see what he was doing through the window. How is that story of abuse and trauma connected to why she spends so much time in the portal online?
So this is autobiographical too. I was told that story as a child, and there are other things I think that happen in the first book, the first half of the book. Her autistic cousin, for instance, that she's still seeing with a child's eyes. Maybe she's not necessarily thinking about them as abuse, and she's sort of just presenting them, you know, as this story I was told when I was a child that I haven't examined more deeply. But I just always had that image of my Uncle Pete, who also became a priest, which is a very nice little detail, just, you know, sitting there, and he's chained up, I think, because, you know, my great-grandmother was worried about what the world meant to him, you know, what it could represent to him in terms of danger. She wanted to be able to see him at all times, but it also meant that he watched the world in a different way. You know, if you were sitting on that patch of grass that had been granted to you, it meant also that he learned to watch in a different way.
Let's talk a little bit about your writing style. Do the fragments come to you fully formed?
Yes, basically, yes. When they're good, they come to me fully formed. If I find that I'm really, really overworking something, it probably needs to be chucked out. I think it's a lot like poetry, where a good line will arrive in the way that a good joke will. And it's just absolutely like that. It's a physical response. It comes out of your mouth almost whole. And it doesn't seem like it could have been written any other way. So the ones that come out that way are usually the ones that stay. And the ones that I'm just like sitting there with that lump of Play-Doh, just working it and working it while it gets worse and worse and worse. Those are usually the ones that you have to let them go. You know, you feel that you're pouring your sweat and your blood into those, but it's also like you're also working over them so hard sometimes because they're not working. So just let them go. Just let that ugly thing be.
What was one that you worked over and you worked over and you just couldn't quite make it work in this particular book?
Well, this is funny. No, I don't think this would work in any book. But when I was revising the book, I did have first active coronavirus, and then like a little bit of a post-COVID period where I was not mentally completely on my game. And I decided in this delirium that I needed to include this anecdote about traveling, the protagonist traveling with her sister to Scotland, where they peed together next to Rob Roy's grave. And really nothing else happened. So they're peeing together next to Rob Roy's grave. And, you know, the narrator's husband, you know, asks her, like, why these people came to visit Rob Roy's grave. Like, why did they bring him flowers, lay stones on his headstone? Like, what exactly did Rob Roy do? And the narrator's like, he did everything. He did it all. He was Rob Roy. And I thought at the time that that was the most profound thing that anyone had ever come up with. And I worked on this for weeks, and I was obsessed with working in the peeing next to Rob Roy's grave thing. And then I was like, oh, wait, I have coronavirus. So we're just not going to ever talk about that again. There are a couple things in there. Actually, there are like two more coronavirus things that are in the book, and only I will ever know what they are. And I'll take it to my grave with me, to my Rob Roy grave.
Fair. You shared the Rob Roy. I will not press you farther. You know, obviously, as a poet, you love words. And even with the fragments are beautifully put together. And clearly, you've worked on them. And they, even if they've come to you perfectly formed, you've figured out what order they should be in and what rhythm they should be in and who with what they should be paired with. So what was it that you wanted to explore about language? It's so interesting after hearing you describe really having to work and massage these fragments, and then to think about the way you write about and your narrator thinks about language.
I think people talk about Twitter, about the portal, as like a jumble of meaningless fragments thrown together. But I think we experience tremendous meaning in the portal. And I think that the meaning comes through that contrast, that juxtaposition. I think we are experiencing a narrative in there that is supplied by the way those fragments lie against each other. I think it's different for every other person. It's different every time, but it is a narrative. It is some kind of meaning. And I knew all the way back, like to when I started, that of course I wanted to write about the language. That is what we have been doing there. That's what we were doing there at the very beginning, when Twitter was good in 2011, in those days where it seemed like we were building something something together. And it was absolutely collaborative. And if we were starting to sound a bit like each other, it was in a way like we were a collective, like we were some sort of comedy team who was all working in tandem. And I liked that a lot, because I think that's how language happens. And I think it's how new language happens. And I think at the beginning of all new language, there's people talking about how crappy it is, basically, right? Or how it isn't real. It's not the stuff that you can write books out of, you know, that it's not as good as what we had before. And I think it is always as good as what we had before, because it's what we use to speak to each other. Mm-hmm. So I wanted, even in the second half of the book, to show that she still thinks in that language, that she even like talks to the baby in that language, that right. She wants to read the baby Wikipedia. All of these things that make up the new fabric of her life, those things are real. It is a real language, and she can use it to talk to people.
We hold our book club in the weeks prior to this live event on Instagram, and we are always putting up questions, having discussions. So we asked our listeners whether they thought the protagonist should quit the portal entirely. 69% said yes. 31% said no.
So 69% thoughts? Said yes. It's the perfect internet number. You couldn't have engineered it more beautifully. It's the sex number. I can't even believe how good that is. I mean, yeah, she should probably leave. It is this very funny thing where people are like, do you have the same relationship with Twitter as you previously did? And it's like, no, I don't think anyone has the same relationship with Twitter that they previously did. Mm-hmm. But I am, you know, there now because I'm talking about a book that I've released, and it's right. Kind of a thing you have to do. So yeah, I think the 69% are probably right on the money. I would like to hear more from that 31% because they might be even more online than me.
Let's talk about the second half of the book, when we see the protagonist with her sister, who's learned that a child has this condition known as Proteus syndrome, which your niece has. Proteussyndrome.org describes it this way. Proteus syndrome is a condition which involves atypical growth of the bones, skin, and head, and can lead to a variety of other symptoms. The condition is caused by a genetic mutation in AKT1, an important gene that helps to regulate the growth of cells. In this book, this is based on your real niece, Lena, and you write about her. This is for Lena, who was a belle.
Yes.
Why was that a good description of Lena?
It is because there was a moment where my sister and I discovered that she responded to music when she was in utero. Mm. And the first time it ever happened was the Negulesco overture for the movie How to Marry a Millionaire. And she started really responding to the horns. And I thought, well, there's really something to that. So I started playing her all this old musicals, soundtracks. And she loved the song, If I Were a Bell, from Guys and Dolls. She responded to it. She would cycle her legs. She would pump her arms. And she was experiencing sheer, complete sensory excitement. The only way she could experience those things, that kind of feeling, mm-hmm. is if you brought them to her. She wasn't going to, you know, just start hearing a song out of nowhere on her own. We realized at some point that we had to bring her these things, like flowers, that we had to show them to her, lay them in her lap, really, and show her the things of the world. So, yeah, and that, to me, that pure responsiveness, it was not just about the song, but it was about her, that she was a bell, just swinging back and forth and ringing and ringing.
You write about Lena in the acknowledgments. You were not here to teach us, but we did learn. Yeah. What did you learn?
I mean, everything. I write in the book that it was something like the feeling of travel, that you were put back in your body again, that you were the slap of your soles on the pavement, and you were, you know, the palms of your hands, that you were your eyes experiencing these new sights. So you were interpreting the world for her. So you were seeing all those things again. You were seeing the meaning of them, and you were thinking about what they meant to you. Again, she was like a flower. She was something that needed air and needed water and needed love. And you represented those things. And the education was just bringing them to her. And so you would see them yourself again for the first time.
It was beautiful to hear you describe wanting to take your niece out into the world, and the protagonist does as well. They want to take the child out and have her experience the world, but they start to realize, the narrator starts to realize, the world can be a scary place because people can be horrible. In the book, it says, a teenager on the nighttime ferry snuck his phone over her shoulder to take a picture of the baby in her special stroller. Though by that time, it seemed baffling. She didn't look that different from other babies, did she? He was taking pictures because of her sweetness, her freshness, not because he was going to post them, right? Is the internet frightening? Is the portal frightening for your narrator now, as someone who got so much from it and was so devoted to it?
Maybe in that way, possibly in that moment. But I think what the narrator is experiencing and what I experienced myself was sheer bafflement again. Mm-hmm. Because when you speak in terms of education, there is also something that is the education of the eye. Mm. When a doctor tells you about a syndrome, when your doctor says, you know, this is what Proteus syndrome is, don't look it up. What they mean is that you'll, you know, go to Google Images and that you will potentially experience a moment of shock because you're registering something that is not what you expect. But when you are talking about individuals, when you're talking about people you know, when you're talking about your own niece, the eye is educated. She is herself. That is how she looks. She is beautiful. And I think it's so important later that what the narrator realizes too is that it wouldn't frighten her. You know, after the child is gone, to put her picture in the portal, because then people would see her. Mm. That is a sort of continuance of her. And then, in fact, what she wanted at that time just was for people to see her.
What do you think is the biggest piece of knowledge that the narrator learns in the second half of the book?
I think it is just, there's a moment where the narrator, her husband is calling to tell her about a news story about people, you know, enemies shooting a word into someone's brain through radio waves. And she's like, oh my God, like, can they do it with any word? And he's like, yeah, any word. And she's like, maybe something like that is what happened to me, that someone just shot the word love into my heart, that it is just that word, this, not even just her name, but just the word love, love, love.
Those were highlights from my conversation with author Patricia Lockwood from our March Get Lit with All of It virtual book club event. We spent the month reading her debut novel, No One Is Talking About This. Coming up next, Patricia answers questions from our virtual audience. Stay tuned. All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. This hour, we're airing highlights from our March Get Lit with All of It virtual book club event. We spent the month reading the novel No One Is Talking About This, the debut novel from acclaimed poet and memoirist Patricia Lockwood. 5,319 New Yorkers checked out a copy of the novel, thanks to our partners at the New York Public Library. And as always, our readers had some excellent questions for Tricia. We began with a question from a viewer named Catherine, who wanted to know how Patricia came up with a post that caused our protagonist to go viral. That post was, can a dog be twins?
I needed something that was plausibly a tweet that could go big. And tweets that go big are sometimes things that almost don't mean anything. So I was like, it needs to almost mean nothing, but have that special ring to it. And of course, one of the real jokes of the book is that she becomes famous just on the basis of this single tweet. You know, it's like she's traveling the world, she's going to Australia simply because of Can a Dog Be Twins.
Were you surprised when your piece, Rape Joke, this is an acclaimed poem essay. If anybody hasn't read it, you should read it. Were you surprised when it went viral?
I don't really know that I had an idea that poems could go viral then. This was sort of before, you know, there's like a time of like Instagram and Twitter virality for this kind of thing. It might have been one of the earlier examples of that. So no, I had not thought about that at all. It was very overwhelming. And it was also when I was living with my parents in the period depicted in Pre-Study. So I think if, you know, if it hadn't been in a situation where I already had a lot else to deal with, that I probably would have been very laser focused on the situation. But as it was, I was like, you know what, I gotta, you know, go on a road trip with my mom now. So it's fine. But no, I did not expect it at all. Yeah, and it was really my first experience with that sort of, not fame, but just something being ever present. Or now when I'm introduced, you know, at festivals and conferences and things, like I'll be introduced that way, which always throws you out of it a little bit because you think, oh yeah, that is how people know me.
Nancy asks, how do you feel about the monetization of personal information on the internet?
Yeah, I would say that that's something that we weren't seeing as much in those days I speak about as being the good days. I mean, way back when you started out as a blogger, you remember when like the first bloggers put ads on their blogs, and that was this very controversial decision. It was like, what is what the mommy bloggers are doing? Is that okay? But it may just be something to do with the vehicle. I mean, I have written a book about my niece. I've written a book about my family. So that's also a form of monetization. You can say that something is a higher art than another thing. But yeah, it may just be a different vector.
This is from Instagram. What about Ken? Hi, Patricia. Love the book. Just wanted to ask, what has your online routine been since you finished the book? And do you look at your time spent differently now?
I think that I do. You would think maybe that quarantine would be the perfect time for me to absolutely make the final dive into my phone where I never come out on the other side. And they're like, where did she go? There's just a little grease spot on the ground here. Where's Trisha? That might be the time. But no, because I got COVID, I didn't. I was like, wait a minute. Whoa, I don't want to be here. That's not something I want to be doing. And it was already starting to be true, you know, after my niece passed away. And you do see, you know, it sounds like corny, or it's, you know, it's very overused language, but you do see that certain things are more important, that, you know, this, it is important to be in your body sometimes doing the necessary and the crucial things. But for me, in terms of, you know, the daily routine of the internet, the only thing is that I just can't look at Twitter first thing. Especially so, I would say, when Trump was in office. But like, even now, you can't look at it first thing because it takes over your brain for the day. It sets the topics, and that's what you're going to be thinking about. And it's going to be a thing where it's like, do I have to? I was like trying to figure out today who Chet Hanks was, and I was like, you know, climbing backward through the. And I'm like, who is this guy? Does he even look like Tom Hanks? What's going on with him? What's a white boy summer? I don't understand any of this. So I think that sometimes people just stay in the portal. Because like, if you're out too long, you miss that stuff. And then you have to scramble for information when you sign back in. But if you go on first thing, that's your brain for the day. It's done.
Caitlin asks, did anything personal inspire the first half of the book, the fame, the notoriety from your experience, or was it just meant to satirize our current moment?
So no, a lot of that was autobiographical as well, particularly the travel items. Rob Roy might not have made it in, but many other travel things that came about because of Pre-Study and my other writing. A lot of those were real, travels around the world and things like that. And there are as well family elements that are autobiographical. It's really just more, I don't know. So you're sort of, she's kind of this dispersed personality, right? Mm-hmm. She's not just herself. She is other people. She's other people's viewpoints. She's like whole arguments that sets of people are having. So it's not just about like a singularity. It's not just about a single person. In that sense, it can't be entirely autobiographical because it's something that we all created together. It's all of us forming this personality.
Has it been hard at all to talk about your niece?
No, that has been wonderful, I think. It was the fact that the promotional push started like right around January 6th. So I was talking about all of this at basically the most stressful, like hair falling out time that you could possibly think of. But there was, you know, a moment in the first couple of interviews where I was kind of feeling out my way. And like I told you before, I pathologically tell the truth. And I thought I can't maintain some fiction where I don't say say which things are true or which things really happened. Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk about what really happened. I did an interview with the New York Times, and we just got so stuck. We were just looking at each other, trying to have this real conversation. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards, I emailed her, and I was like, I think that I just the whole time like wanted to show you her picture. Because if we had been together in real life in a park or something, or like getting mm-hmm. drinks, I would have just shown you my phone, and I would have showed you her picture on my phone. And so mm-hmm. I was able to break through after that, I think, because I think that is what I really wanted. I really wanted to talk about her. That hasn't been hard at all.
What's next for you? What are you working on?
It's funny. I did in these early insurrection interviews, I like lightly mentioned that I was working on some short stories. And then it came out in all of these like pieces about me that I was working on a collection of short stories. So...
Was there something that you'd like to read about yourself? We can just throw it out there now.
I was like, you know what? I guess I am committed to write a collection of short stories now, and all of us are going to get to read that in 4 years, something like that. But it might be true. It might be true. We'll see.
Those were highlights from the Q&A portion of our March Get Lit with All of It virtual book club event with author Patricia Lockwood. We spent the month reading her novel, No One Is Talking About This. Coming up next, two special performances from John Darnielle, who performs as the Mountain Goats.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.